I would love for people in Alaska to come out of the closet and say, yeah, this is ridiculous. Let's make this legal.
The Marijuana Initiative is one step closer to being on the ballot. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Friday, June 14th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, unprecedented flooding of Rabbit Creek stuns South Anchorage residents.
There's no road there anymore. It's just a crevasse with water pouring into it. It's just crazy. I haven't seen anything like this.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Don't wait to make your home more energy smart. Alaska Housing Finance Corporation's Home Energy Rebate Program will reimburse you for energy efficiency improvements. And if you don't have the upfront cash to make the investment, financing is available through Alaska Housing Finance Corporation. Start saving money and energy today. Sign up at akrebate.com or call 877-257-3228. This message sponsored by AHFC.
An initiative to set up a legal market for marijuana has cleared a hurdle for getting on the ballot. Lieutenant Governor Mead Treadwell certified that the initiative language conformed with Alaska statute this afternoon, just one day short of his deadline. That means initiative sponsors can start circulating petitions to show that a sufficient number of Alaskans want to vote on the issue. The sponsors need more than 30,000 signatures to do that. Tim Hinterberger is a professor at the University of Alaska Anchorage, an occasional marijuana user, and a sponsor of the initiative. He says that wins in states like Washington and Colorado show that public opinion is shifting toward legalization.
I would love for people in Alaska, like me, who have no reason to hide it, to come out of the closet and say, yeah, this is ridiculous. Let's make this legal.
This isn't Alaska's first pro-marijuana initiative. In 2000, a similar proposition appeared on the ballot, but barely cleared 40% of the vote. Sponsors tried again in 2004 and closed the gap by a few percentage points. Hinterberger thinks this initiative has some advantages over past efforts. It doesn't give amnesty to people who have violated drug laws, and it also provides a roadmap for establishing a legal marijuana market.
The language has been carefully crafted to provide a lot of guidance to the state on how cannabis should be regulated and taxed and made available. So it's just really a better thought out approach than in the past.
As with alcohol, you would have to be over 21 to consume marijuana. It would be sold in stores and subject to a lot of the same laws that govern alcohol. The initiative would allow communities to ban marijuana establishments through their own city laws. Right now, Alaskans are allowed to possess small amounts of marijuana in their homes, but the sale of marijuana is still a crime. Anchorage's Rabbit Creek flooded this morning. Water flowed over a bridge and downed logs caused excess water to spill onto lawns and yards. The water caused major damage to a road and a bridge in the area. KSKA's Daisha Eaton has more.
Georgia Tolbert stands at a debris-covered bridge in South Anchorage near her house, watching the water flow over it.
It looks like a little Niagara Falls right there where the road is supposed to be. There's no road there anymore. It's just a crevasse with water pouring into it. It's just crazy. I haven't seen anything like this. It looks like a war zone or something.
Around noon Friday, water was flowing over the banks of Rabbit Creek and down her neighbor Melita Buchanan's driveway.
That's one of our driveways, and luckily it's going back into the creek. See, right there. And now we're going to go to the house, and I'll show you the damage in the back.
She and her husband, Garner, first noticed the flooding around 9:30 Friday morning. They heard boulders and trees crashing down the creek, which runs past their house. 30 minutes later, a transformer blew, and they lost power. They've lived along Rabbit Creek for more than 50 years. They say they've never seen such destructive flooding, which took out a footbridge near their house.
This is the biggest. But we had a bridge across there that was taken out.
By noon, water was rushing over a bridge near their house, and authorities had closed the road. The asphalt was breaking off in chunks, and the creek was forming new channels. George Vicalis, the city manager for Anchorage, says warmer than usual temperatures may have triggered an earthen dam to break at Rabbit Lake, sending more debris and water rushing down the creek. Vicalis says the municipality and the state are monitoring the situation.
This is probably the most severe of the bridges right now that has the water going over it. And so we're watching this bridge pretty carefully. We're going to have to go in and inspect that particular bridge just to make sure it's safe for travel. It probably has been compromised as a result, but we're not sure right now. We won't know until we get in there.
Edward Bosco is chairman of the Birch Tree Elmore Limited Road Service Area, which maintains roadways in the area. He says the culvert's plugged up and it happened quick.
The police called me out here at 9:15 this morning, and I came right down here and I talked to people who were here at 8:30, and there was nothing crossing the road at that time. Evidently, something cut loose and all of a sudden it came down and plugged everything up quickly.
Bosco says he's already asked both the municipality and the state for help repairing the road. He estimates fixing the bridge will drain the road service area bank account, and they'll need help to get it back in shape. Georgia Tolbert, who lives across the bridge and uses it to get to and from town, says she anticipates taking the long way around for a while.
It's going to take, you know, a week or more to fix this, even after they redirect they're going to have to redirect the creek and then, of course, repair the road. So it's quite a mess.
Neighbors say three homes were evacuated, but so far there's no word of any serious damage and no injuries reported. In Anchorage, I'm Daisha Eaton.
A forecast heat wave has wildfire officials on alert. State Fire Information Officer Sarah Sarlos says the conditions coming together could spell trouble.
Red flag warnings are expected statewide, and they could last for a while. Lightning is predicted in the interior, eastern interior, and also into south central.
Sarlo says firefighting resources, including crews and equipment, have been ramped up and pre-positioned statewide to respond. She says conditions are ripe for both lightning and human-caused fires.
So we need people to be aware of any burn suspensions in their area, and also just to be heads up because we are in fire season is in full swing.
Firefighters responded to an unattended burn pile in the Fairbanks area yesterday. A handful of Western senators are warning of dire effects on salmon fisheries in their states if the EPA allows the Pebble mine to proceed. APRN's Peter Granitz reports that the Pebble partnership is now arguing that commercial fishing does not significantly benefit Alaska.
Pebble Partnership CEO John Shively is in Washington, D.C. this week lobbying Congress, which has no authority over whether the mine proceeds. The EPA could veto the mine outright if it deems the project too damaging to the region's watersheds. Shively says he understands the concerns of the senators, but their fears would be allayed by the environmental review process. He says the commercial salmon industry in Alaska is losing its importance.
You know, you have to understand the reason that five senators from the West Coast can write a letter about the salmon industry is because so many salmon fishermen don't live in Alaska. They take our resource and they go someplace else to spend their money.
The five senators represent California, Oregon, and Washington State. They're all Democrats, and the only person missing from those delegations is Oregon's Ron Wyden. He chairs the Senate Energy Committee. They fired off a letter to the EPA referencing a study from the University of Alaska Institute of Economic and Social Research showing Bristol Bay salmon contributes hundreds of millions of dollars to their states. Oregon Senator Jeff Merkley says he has not yet heard from the EPA. The letter went out Monday.
Oregon has a very large salmon fishery. And so, of course, the salmon went through in the ocean. They could travel all over. Keeping our salmon runs in Oregon healthy benefit other fishermen in other states.
But Shively says the benefits are not necessarily in the state. He says that many people in rural southwest Alaska cannot afford the costs associated with commercial fishing.
The commercial fishing industry might be an answer for California, Washington, and Oregon, but it's not right now an answer for people that live out in southwest Alaska, which is why people, I think more and more people, are willing to look at whether or not Pebble could solve some of those economic problems.
Not according to commercial fisherman Lindsay Bloom. She's a longtime critic of the proposed mine and has run her fishing boat in Bristol Bay for 15 years.
I have only increased my profitability since I got in.
She says high prices make up for low catch years, and by and large, the price of salmon has steadily risen, and she expects the same this season. Bloom is the incoming chair of the Environment Committee for the United Fishermen of Alaska. She says commercial fishing accounts for 14,000 jobs in Bristol Bay.
The seafood industry in Alaska is the number one private sector employer.
The Pebble Partnership has yet to submit an application. Shively says that could happen this year, but he concedes he has said that for years. The permitting process would take several more. In Washington, D.C., I'm Peter Granitz.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, scientists learn techniques for studying sea ice from Inupiat whalers.
These locals are not geophysicists, but they are what you can clearly refer to as sea ice experts.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
As an active senior, your independence is important to you. One of the ways for you to maintain your independence is to reduce your risk of falling. A fall risk assessment can be part of your initial or annual Medicare exam. They'll ask about your vision and review your medications for possible problems. Learn ways to improve balance, strengthen muscles, and reduce hazards at home. Contact your Medicare provider for an appointment. This message in good health is sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
The National Transportation Safety Board has released its preliminary report on last week's fatal crash of a float plane near Petersburg. The report summarizes the circumstances in the June 4th accident, but does not yet include a probable cause for that fatal crash. KFSK's Joe Viknicki reports.
According to the report, the Pacific Wings de Havilland Beaver with a pilot and six cruise ship passengers left the float plane dock in Petersburg at 3:19 on the afternoon of Tuesday, June 4th, headed to Leconte Bay for a flight seeing trip. The pilot told an NTSB investigator that the flight was his fourth of that day and his third tour flight. He reported weather conditions that had been deteriorating throughout the day with a ceiling of 2,000 feet, light rain and fog along the mountain ridges. The pilot told the NTSB he tried to fly through a mountain pass on the way to the glacier and initiated a left-hand turn to avoid rising terrain right before crashing into the forested mountainside. The plane went down at 3:40 that afternoon on the steep mountainside at 912 feet above sea level. Bryce Banning, an air safety investigator with the NTSB, says it's still early in the investigation. Banning says he's looked at the crash site and interviewed the pilot and passengers and considered other facts from the accident.
We looked at some information provided by the company that they use to track the aircraft as it's flying. We interviewed the pilot, visited with him about weather conditions, the flight itself, and what transpired.
66-year-old Thomas L. Rising of Santa Fe, New Mexico, was killed in the crash. He and five others, Frank and Amy Allen, along with their sons Will, Rob, and Ben, were passengers on the cruise ship Seabird. They were on an Alaska cruise offered by Lindblad Expeditions and National Geographic. Those five, along with the pilot, survived the crash and were rescued from the site. The pilot reported no mechanical problems before the accident happened. An emergency locator transmitter on the plane signaled the U.S. Coast Guard about 7 minutes after the impact, and a Coast Guard search began about a half hour later. The company's tracking system also let Pacific Wings employees know the float plane was no longer transmitting along the planned route. The crash site and survivors were discovered by a Coast Guard helicopter at 6:16 that evening. NTSB's Banning describes the crash site as a treacherous location and says there's work left to do.
It takes time, and we're still really in the fact-gathering stage. The insurance representatives of the insurance company are looking or working towards recovering the aircraft, where the NTSB will have a chance, an opportunity again to go through the wreckage in a controlled environment.
The NTSB does not identify a probable cause until it issues a final report, which can take up to a year to complete. In Petersburg, I'm Joe Viknicki.
The Alaska Department of Health and Social Services confirms that a woman from an unnamed southwest Alaska village has been hospitalized with symptoms of botulism. KDLG's Mike Mason has the story.
Health officials are not releasing the woman's name, but they confirmed that she was taken to the Alaska Native Medical Center in Anchorage Wednesday night. Epidemiologists with the Division of Public Health contacted the woman's family, who reported that she had consumed fermented beaver tail, seal oil, and some beluga. No one else apparently ate the food, which was subsequently thrown away. Greg Wilkinson is a spokesman for the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services. He confirms that efforts are underway to try and pinpoint the exact cause of the botulism.
We've asked the family to try to retrieve what they can and send us samples. So if we do receive some samples, they will be tested to see if we can pinpoint which of the food sources do have that botulism toxin in them.
Wilkinson says two staff members with the Alaska Department of Health will be headed to the village to conduct some education about botulism to prevent additional people from getting sick.
What can really bring about an increased amount of the botulism toxin is that many people today are using more modern methods of fermenting. They use Tupperware containers or they use plastic bags, and when they seal them up without any oxygen getting to it, the botulism bacterium really tends to multiply even faster than it does if it's left exposed to the air. So it's really recommended that if you're going to do this, that you use traditional native methods where they would wrap them in moss or peat or cover them in straw and bury them in the ground, rather than using more modern methods like plastics or Tupperware.
The Alaska Department of Health and Social Services confirms that 98 cases of botulism were reported back in the 1990s, with another 57 cases reported since the year 2000. Between 1950 and 2010, there were a total of 283 cases of botulism reported in Alaska, resulting in 20 deaths. Botulism is a serious illness caused by a deadly poison, and botulism has been known to result in death. The Department of Health reports that almost all cases of botulism in Alaska have been caused from eating fermented native foods, such as fermented beaver tail, stinky eggs, and stinky heads, seal oil, or blubber. Wilkinson asserts that it's nearly impossible to tell if a food product has been contaminated with botulism.
You can't tell if something's been contaminated with botulism, and even a small taste of it can be seriously poisonous. So tasting it is not a good idea either. It's a risk. It's a risk that you take when you eat naturally fermented foods like that.
Symptoms of botulism include weakness on both sides of the body, starting at the head and moving down the body, blurred vision, dry mouth, diarrhea, vomiting, nausea, and trouble breathing. In Dillingham, I'm Mike Mason.
An annual gathering of Alaska Native people focused on healing, sobriety, and other health objectives wrapped up in Fairbanks this morning with a traditional staking ceremony. Tananaw Chiefs President Jerry Isaac sang an Athabascan song during the start of the ceremony, at which participants commit themselves to sobriety and other wellness goals by symbolically taking specially prepared and painted wooden stakes. The ceremony included participants from this week's 30th Annual Rural Providers Conference. The annual Yukon 800 boat race will be a little longer this year. The course for the powerboat marathon on the Yukon, Tanana, and Chena Rivers between Fairbanks and Galena and back will be extended all the way to Caltag due to flood damage at the normal halfway layover point. The Fairbanks Outboard Association says the new turnaround point will lengthen the race to about 1,000 miles. The theme for this year's event is Galena Strong. The race dates back to 1961.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Doyon Limited, Interior Alaska's regional native corporation, providing oilfield services, government contracting, and natural resource development in Alaska and across the nation. Information at doyon.com. Every day, people all over Alaska are discovering that public transportation can benefit their businesses and their communities. Public transportation in Alaska provides 7 million rides a year to work, medical appointments, shopping, school, and social opportunities. There's more information at alaskamobility.org. This message sponsored by the nonprofit organizations Alaska Mobility Coalition and the American Public Transportation Association.
Ketchikan,
Kotzebue,
Dillingham,
Sitka,
Chugiak,
Fairbanks,
Fort Yukon,
Wrangell,
Barrow,
Unalaska, Dutch Harbor,
Alaknarechamute.
This is AK on Alaska News Nightly. I'm Dave Waldron. This week on AK, sea ice. Everyone's heard of the rapidly retreating sea ice in the Arctic, but if you're a scientist, how do you actually study what is happening out on a frozen, moving ice cover? The next generation of sea ice scientists learned the basics in Barrow last month. They worked with top polar scientists and an Inupiat whaling captain to study both cutting-edge and traditional techniques for measuring sea ice. One student is bringing the two together. Molly Reddig has the story.
It's a nice spring day in Barrow, 25 degrees with a brisk wind. In an old theater next to the Chukchi Sea, 22 grad students from a University of Alaska Fairbanks class are huddled around Inupiat whaling captain Joe Levitt.
We're going to take you out on the ice today, but this year our ice is all different, and we have no multi-year ice out there. It's just been formed this winter. The problem we had with the ice this year is all winter we had only east winds, hardly any west winds to push the ice back this way. So all winter, maybe until March, we had open water.
There's a lot more movement and cracks in the ice than usual. A couple miles offshore, Levitt showed students how to check cracks using an ice tester, a sturdy 6-foot pole with a thick nail on the end.
If my ice tester didn't go through, I would walk across it. But it went through, I can't walk across it. See, that's why they always have an ice tester.
If the ice breaks, he says to land on the broad side of the pole to spread your weight.
And you can actually crawl to safer ice. See? The way they learn that one is on the young ice, we watched a lot of polar bear falling, and the polar bear will actually get on its belly and then crawl away from it.
The Inupiat have been hunting whales from the edge of the ice for centuries. Scientists are tapping into this huge knowledge base to learn about the behavior of sea ice and how it's changing. Freezing later in the fall, breaking up earlier in the spring, and less stable in between. UAF grad student Oliver DeMon is studying whaling trails around Barrow and the knowledge that goes into building them.
These locals are not geophysicists, but they are what you can clearly refer to as sea ice experts. These people have learned from the ice since they were kids.
Each March, whaling crews build seasonal trails from the beach to the edge of the shore fast ice, as far as 10 miles out, through a maze of ice rubble and tidal cracks. They hack through ridges with ice picks and patch the trail with ice boulders, like road builders, but with only their hands. Then they camp out and wait for a lead to open and a whale to come up to breathe.
They have boats out there and they're trying to get that whale. And once they get it, it's crucial that this point that they find is this ice edge is thick enough so that they can hold this massive whale up on the trail.
DeMon is measuring the thickness of these trails. With a GPS in hand, he tows an electromagnetic conductivity meter in a sled behind the snow machine. It looks like a car battery and shoots electric current into the ice to measure its depth.
Okay, 463 ohms.
A color-coded map shows most of the trails are between 5 and 10 feet thick. He also wants to know why they go where they go. Whalers use lower-tech methods to read the ice.
Because it's a darker color, it's gonna turn black very quick here, you know, get a lot of sunshine. This is a lot of thin ice that's just been pushed out under and under. That's why the color is different over here.
Beginning at freeze-up, they constantly monitor weather, storms, and tons of other factors. One good sign they look for is pressure ridges, mini mountain ranges of ice formed when floating ice smashes into shore-fast ice and anchors it to the sea floor.
What we see out here is that there's very little ridging. It's very smooth ice. And what that does is that the ice gets smoother, so it's easier to access the ice edge, but it's not stabilized as good.
What scientists are learning from the ice and those who live on it can be used by government agencies, industry, and many other groups with a stake in sea ice. In Barrow, I'm Molly Reddig.
Now it's time for 300 Villages. This week we're heading to Sand Point, an island community off the Alaska Peninsula, where residents have recently had a great view of erupting Pavlov Volcano.
My name's Tiffany Jackson. I'm the executive director for the Shawangunkan Tribe of Sand Point. Sand Point is located on Popoff Island in the Shimigan Islands. It's a small town. I believe the island itself is about 7 by 14 miles. The community is about 1 by 3 miles. Surrounded by water, beautiful God's country. We do get subject to some severe weather and winds, but for the most part, it's a beautiful place. We can see the volcano. When it first was active, In the evenings, we were able to see the lava shooting out of the volcano. It's been a pretty daily experience to see the ash plume. We only have one airline that comes in and out of Sandpoint. And so for, I believe it was about a week, we didn't have any flights due to the ash from the volcano. I believe it's one of the more active volcanoes in the state of Alaska. I remember it being active when I was going to school. I remember the school coming out on the lawn to watch the volcano explode. It's a fishing community. I believe most of the families make a living somehow related to the fishery. There's three tribes located in Sandpoint. We are the Shawinigan tribe of Sandpoint, but there's also the Palaf Harbor tribe located here and the Unga tribe. We have a culture camp that goes on every July. So kids, they come to camp and we do bentwood hats, Bering Sea headdresses, full crown headdresses. They make regalia. They sing, they dance. We do traditional foods. We've done drum making. They've made kayaks in the past, and we've taught boating safety and navigation. You know, it's a place where you can feel comfortable letting your kids go out to play and not worry too much about them. It's a real community.
Tiffany Jackson lives in Sandpoint, Alaska. 300 Villages is AK's attempt to put every community in Alaska on the radio. Thanks for listening to AK this week. We had help from Molly Reddick, Sarah Bernard, and Annie Fite. Tune in next week for more unique stories from around the state. I'm Dave Waldron.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Dacia Eaton in Anchorage, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Joe Vicknicki in Petersburg, Mike Mason in Dillingham, and Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau. APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez reported from Juneau and Peter Granitz from Washington, D.C. Our editor and producer is Annie Fite. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Kristen Spack is our web producer, and I'm Lori Townsend. Have a great weekend.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station. Join Alaska bars and restaurants from every corner of the state in taking a stand against secondhand smoke. The fact of the matter is, no Alaskan, employee, or customer should suffer the heart disease and lung cancer due to secondhand smoke. The benefits are undeniably positive for Alaskans and for the bottom line. Clean indoor air. It's good for health, and it's great for business. For more information on smoke-free workplaces, visit alaskatca.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Tobacco Control Alliance. The Alaskan Nanook Commission reminds you that harassing polar bears or taking polar bears with cubs is not only illegal, but it is not part of Native traditions. Together with their management partners at the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, the Alaskan Nanook Commission has been working on developing a long-term polar bear deterrence plan to protect Alaska's villages from dangerous polar bear encounters. More at the AlaskaNanookCommission.org. This message sponsored by the Alaskan Nanook Commission, Alaska's people managing Alaska's resources. Complete a bachelor program without leaving home. Whether a first-time or transfer student, the University of Alaska Southeast has the degree for you. Visit ketch.alaska.edu. This message sponsored by the University of Alaska Southeast.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.